This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Amy Chua, who is the John M. Duff Jr. Professor of Law at Yale Law School and the author of a new book, Day of Empire: How Hyperpowers Rise to Global Dominance and Why They Fall. Amy, welcome back to Berkeley.
Thank you. Thanks
When did you get the idea for the book?
Actually, right after I wrote my first book, World on Fire, one question I got everywhere was, so, you know, France's foreign minister had just declared that the United States was a hyperpower. The question I got was, how long are we going to stay a hyperpower? And, you know, is China going to overtake us? Is the EU going to overtake us? So I decided to focus on hyperpowers.
And how long did it take you to write the book?
4 or 5 years, nonstop.
I believe it after reading the book. And you are a professor of law, but this is really comparative history, a very rich comparative history.
Well, there's a theme in it, as we'll get to. It's about tolerance, and that is something that we talk about in the law. And also, you know, my field is really rule of law in developing countries, nation building, and there is a nation building and empire building question in the book as well.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about what the book is telling us. What is a hyperpower?
Well, a hyperpower is, first of all, a really rare thing. It's not just an empire, not just a superpower. I'm referring to these remarkably few societies in all of history that amassed such extraordinary economic and military might that they basically towered over all their rivals and essentially dominated the world. So France's foreign minister was the one that coined this term in 1999. He declared, United States has become the world's single hyperpower, you know, dominant in all categories, economically, militarily, technologically, and culturally. You know, and France is not going to have it. But that's the concept. And just to give you an example, the United States during the Cold War was not a hyperpower, mm-hmm. because back then it had a formidable rival, the former Soviet Union, you know, of roughly comparable strength.
So it's very important to understand that we're really talking about relative power at the time when the hyperpower existed.
Right, and it's unusual. I mean, the much more normal state of affairs in history is to have lots of a multipolar world where you have lots of states rising and falling, they're battling with each other. It's actually, where I discovered this in my research, it's really unusual to have a situation, I mean, the stars have to be aligned, where there's just really one power that kind of towers over everybody else.
Tolerance also needs to be explained. We're obviously familiar with the term in today's world, in today's discourse, but it's not a term you normally would think of applying to, for example, Genghis Khan.
Right. I mean, I'm glad you asked because to jump ahead a little bit, my thesis is that the one thread that links all the hyperpowers of history, and they're not that many, is that every hyperpower in history, you know, rose to global dominance through tolerance, that tolerance was indispensable. So as I'm using the term, I don't mean tolerance in the modern human rights sense, the ideal sense. By tolerance, I don't mean equality or even respect. Rather, by tolerance, I just mean letting lots of different kinds of people, you know, even if you don't particularly like them or respect them, live, participate, prosper, and rise in your society, regardless of ethnicity, race, nationality, and even if it's only for instrumental reasons. So it's a relative concept, too. You know, in my book, what matters is really just whether a nation is more tolerant than its rivals, not whether it's tolerant in some sort of absolute universalistic sense.
And what I think you're suggesting, especially in the early hyperpowers, is that tolerance is a key to the power that gives us the hyperpower.
Yes, it seems at first surprising, but there's actually a really simple explanation. Basically, remember, my thesis, my book is only about hyperpowers. It's how do you be world dominant? You know, there are lots of ways to achieve great power, but how do you dominate the world? And the idea is that in order to dominate the world, a society has to be at the very cutting edge frontier of the world's technological, economic, and military frontier. And you need, in order to have that, you've got to be able to pull in the world's best and brightest. Because at any given point in history, the world's most valuable human capital, whether in terms of intelligence or creativity, drive, skills, physical strength, the world's most valuable human capital is never going to be found within any one ethnic group or within any one religion. So to pull away from your rivals on a global scale, you've got to be able to pull in, you know, the best and brightest from the world. So in ancient times, it was really simple. This kind of strategic tolerance was the only way you could build a huge military. You know, if you limit your army to only, say, pure-blooded Spartans, your army's going to be inherently limited in size. I mean, how many pure-blooded Spartans are there? But if you open up your military to warriors of any nationality or race, you can amass a really huge military. And that's what the Achaemenid Persians did and what Rome did.
Right. And were you surprised when you found this, when you go back to the Persian Empire and find that Darius was tolerant? Was this unexpected?
I was completely surprised. First of all, I think most of us in the United States, when we think of antiquity, we think of Greece and Rome. And I knew very little about the Achaemenid Persian Empire. It was only when I was kind of searching through history with research assistants that I found the Achaemenid Persian Empire, founded in 550 BC by Cyrus the Great. I had no idea. That kingdom basically ruled one-third of the world's total population, you know, 40 million people. And it swallowed up and just annexed, you know, the great kingdoms of Mesopotamia, Assyria, Egypt, Babylonia, and the Greek city-state. So it was huge, and I'd never really heard of it. But again, it's not that Darius the Great was tolerant in our human rights sense. This man impaled people and poked their eyes out, and, you know, I mean, there were slaves. It was a very brutal society. I only mean tolerance in the sense that he let everybody into his military. He took craftsmen and warriors and builders from every part of his kingdom, and they basically amassed the largest war machine, you know, that the earth had ever seen. And that part is sort of intuitive. It was surprising at first, but it's intuitive. How else do you build the biggest army?
Right. And it's really the Romans who go furthest to achieving hyperpowerdom and sort of addressing this problem in a more substantial way. That is, how do you actually control the large numbers of people that come under your domain?
Right. Hyperpowers face special problems because they extend their reach over so many diverse populations. So starting with Achaemenid Persia, what I mean by tolerance is Darius the Great and Cyrus the Great build these giant armies, but they also really were religiously tolerant. So other rival kings, they would, you know, when you conquer a land, they would sort of suppress local cults and say, try to impose their own gods to show their power. Cyrus the Great, very shrewdly, the Persians, they did the opposite. They actually allowed local peoples to follow their own customs, speak their own languages, worship their own gods, and he actually he embraced local gods because that gave him legitimacy. So that was, to answer your question, that kind of tolerance was one way of making conquered peoples more compliant. You know, they're less likely to rebel. But Rome went so much further in two ways. First, there was no ethnic ceiling in Rome. In Persia, all of the governors and certainly the people in the very highest positions of authority, they were all Persian. You know, the number one position, they were all Persians. Mm-hmm. Not so in Rome. The Romans permitted educated men of any race or nationality to rise to the very highest positions of authority, including even the position of emperor. Mm-hmm. You know, people, I didn't realize that, for example, Septimius Severus was a North African. He was an emperor. He was married to a Syrian. Very colorblind. The second way that Rome was even more masterfully tolerant in this strategic way is that Rome managed to Romanize all of these conquered peoples. The Persians had a terrible time. They conquered people, but the Greeks still felt Greek. The Egyptians still felt Egyptian. They certainly didn't feel proud to be part of the Persian Empire, and that's why the empire quickly kind of split apart. It was only military might that held it together. Rome, by granting citizenship to Gauls and Britons and Africans, made everybody feel Roman. So that was, it was also sort of a form of assimilation accompanied by this kind of tolerance. And that's why I think they lasted so long.
And in reading the book, I had to recall what I had learned in Latin. Civis sum Romanus. I am a citizen of Rome.
And people said that from every corner of the empire. You know, it's absolutely fascinating. From North Africa, Morocco, they felt it, and they dressed like Romans. It was a great honor to be part of the empire.
And if you were a citizen of Rome, there were limits to what the Roman government could do to you. I mean, in our time, you couldn't be rendered, really, because you had rights as a citizen of Rome.
Right. It's both very modern and very pre-modern. It's very pre-modern, and I have to remind, it's important to remind ourselves that this is antiquity. Romans kept many, many slaves. Women didn't have any rights. It's a pre-modern society. But the citizenship, those who got it, and again, it was colorblind, they had lots of rights that are a lot like those in the U.S. Constitution. You know, the right not to be crucified. That's not like the U.S. Constitution, but, rights to hold property, rights to make contract, rights to have almost like certain hearings before things could happen to you.
Well, one of the interesting parts of the book for me was your consideration of the various Chinese dynasties, and one in particular actually confirm the criteria that you had established. Talk a little about that, because most of the others were not that way.
Right, and I always grew up, I'm ethnic Chinese, and I always grew up thinking that, China is just all Han Chinese. It's a quintessentially ethnically defined country. And throughout all of history in China, it's this barbarian versus Han Chinese thing has been dominant. You know, there's the Great Wall of China, very symbolic, closing China in. We've got enough people already, keeping the barbarians out. Well, it turns out that the one dynasty that came closest, I call it a hyperpower, partly because there were very weak other rivals. You know, Europe was just nothing at the time. This is in the 7th century. It was Tang Dynasty China, which, I think most Americans don't know about. It's not as famous as the Ming or the Qing. But Tang Dynasty China was actually founded by somebody that, by our standards today, was half Chinese. He was like part Turkish. You know, he was like a part barbarian from the north. And this was the dynasty, I would say the only dynasty, where the emperors were openly hegemonic. They extended their reach to Persia, basically, in Vietnam. They took over Central Asia. But the key here is that they redefined the Chinese kingdom. These emperors said, barbarians are just like Chinese. You know, I want to be emperor of both. And they took on sort of Turkish titles as well as Chinese titles. So it was very tolerant in this sense. It was the most tolerant of foreigners, Turkish influences, Persian, Arabic, just these things that you don't think of as part of Chinese society. So in Xi'an, that was the capital, it was called Chang'an before, it was the most cosmopolitan capital. I had no idea. If you go there now, there are mosques and, Christian churches, the Nestorian Christianity. There were debates where they had all kinds of different religions, sort of aired and talked as spoken about. So that was a fascinating, and for Chinese, this is actually the Golden Age. Because it was the period of real artistic and poetic flowering. So it was a fascinating case.
I think we have to come back to a point, because I think people who don't read the book and who talk about it will, I think, abuse use of the word tolerance if they want to write a critique of the book. And so I think we want to emphasize that these, especially these ancient empires, it's really the emperors, the Genghis Khan, the king, whatever, could do bad things, and they were doing bad things. But as a way to maximize their power, they used they made use of diversity
exactly.
instead of suppressing it
exactly.
through tolerance.
Exactly. That's perfectly put. You know, instead of killing off or conquered people or enslaving them, they sort of incorporated them and pulled in their best warriors and builders and craftsmen.
I think you're talking about Genghis Khan, and you say he used Chinese engineers who knew how to construct powerful siege engines. There was an openness to the diversity of the different cultures.
That's my favorite case. I never expected this idea of tolerance to extend to Genghis Khan, and I didn't have this idea of tolerance at first, actually. But the Mongols are fascinating. They were nomadic people. They lived on the Mongolian steppes. They were basically illiterate. I mean, even their leaders were illiterate. They had no engineering, no architecture. You know, they lived in tents called yurts made of the felt of yaks. They didn't even have the technology to bake bread. And yet they came to conquer a kingdom far larger than the Romans ever ruled, basically half the known world, including the most spectacular cities, you know, Samarkand, Damascus, Kiev, Moscow, right up to the gates of Vienna. So how did this small group of people without technology do this? That's exactly right. They conquered people, and then they pulled in and sort of recruited those people with the skills and technology they themselves lacked. And the most important were these Chinese engineers, whom they incorporated right into the army. And these Chinese engineers knew how to build the most advanced siege engines of the day. You know, these catapults and that hurled flaming liquids, retractable ladders, portable towers. And it was only by incorporating them that the Mongols were able to overcome the great walled cities of Eastern Europe and Persia and Central Asia.
I'm curious, because when you look at these early empires, you're talking about individuals, the leader. So I want you to help us understand what you're telling us about leadership in this early period, because it's not as if they said, oh, tolerance is a good value,
right.
You know, and I want to make this an end. It's really about maximizing their power.
Right.
So talk a little about that, because it's fascinating.
Right. And I can't myself get into the heads of those leaders, but there is enough historical evidence to suggest that some of it was openly strategic, openly thought about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You could see almost the propaganda, you know, the Darius, the Persian kings. I am king of all the peoples of the world. I treat them all well. You could kind of sense that they are trying to keep people from rebelling. Mm-hmm. They're trying to co-opt the local elites. You know, we're not going to destroy your positions of authority. You could still stay wealthy. Just join the club. So I do think it was very strategic. They were happy to impale or, you know, Genghis Khan, they... very brutal society. If people didn't comply, he would raise entire villages. He used the corpses as moat fill. So this is not about mm-hmm. human rights. But I think it was about how can a small group of people conquer vast territories and then maintain that power. And basically, slavery and persecution is too inefficient. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you can kind of see this in their thinking. It's easier to rule if you have people kind of compliant and happy mm-hmm. and not rebelling, and thinking that you're observing their gods, too. Mm-hmm. And Genghis Khan declared freedom of worship for all his conquered peoples in very modern terms, actually. At the same time, Christian Europe was burning heretics at the stake, killing everybody. They were just splintering apart. I think the largest European empire under Charlemagne was maybe 8 million people. You know, it was just these tolerant Chinese empires, the great Mongol Chinese Empire, 100 million people, 60 million people. And again, strategic tolerance played, you know, a huge role in their ability to conquer and maintain that power.
And what about their education and social class? Is there a common element among these early leaders who saw this truth, or was it,
yeah.
in the case of Genghis Khan, I remember that it was the calculating the way to intermarry and intermix the units of the military and then build on that.
It was fascinating. No common thread among the leaders. Some of the Roman emperors were tremendously educated aristocrats. Genghis Khan was basically a scavenger from from the lowest tribe on the steppe. That's why it's so fascinating. He used the same strategy, and you're exactly right. That's how he united the people of the steppe. They used to bicker and fight and kidnap each other. He united them under this identity, the people of the felt walls. And that's how he united the nomads, built an inter-ethnic army large enough to conquer northern China. But we'll get to this later. That political identity, the people of the felt walls, did not do very well with the civilized populations of Europe and China.
You're making the point throughout the book, and this is where you end up, that there is an evolution of hyper-powerdom, if that's a fair way, the personalities are replaced by processes. And so you say at one point, conquest turns into commerce, invasion to immigration, autocracy to democracy. And I guess that's the best context to then talk about the Dutch, the British, and the Americans.
Right. The interesting thing is that the role of tolerance changes over time because there's the Enlightenment, right? At the same time, what it takes to be a hyperpower changes. In the old days, in ancient times, it was about having the most number of foot soldiers. It was, how do you get to be a hyperpower? You conquer land, you annex it, you loot all their resources, you incorporate their soldiers, and you conquer more land. You know, and at some point, maybe there's overreaching, but that's how you extend. Starting around the 17th century, the greatest way to become powerful isn't just conquering land anymore. That starts to get kind of inefficient. It's about innovation and commerce, controlling the oceans, trade, these huge luxury trades, the spices in East Asia, the gold in the Americas, Africa's resources. So it becomes who can finance these ships that travel all over the place. But what's interesting is that, once again, to be a hyperpower, a modern hyperpower, it's still tolerance. But now the role of tolerance has changed. It's not tolerance in terms of incorporating warriors, but it's what I say is that immigration replaces invasion and annexation as the best way to incorporate the world's best and brightest. So the Dutch were the first. They were the first European state to embrace this new modern ideal of tolerance. You know, not just, as you were saying, Genghis Khan's tolerance, like we can harness human beings like we harness a good mule and then we can, impale them later. Now tolerance with the Enlightenment is a human right. You know, persecution isn't just bad strategy. Mm. Tolerance starts to have overtones of equality and respect. Now, a lot of the European states didn't really live up to those ideals, but it's in the rhetoric. And the Dutch were the first to declare freedom of worship, and almost overnight it transformed itself into a magnet for religious refugees fleeing Europe. I mean, Mennonites, German Lutherans, Sephardic Jews, Pilgrims, Quakers, and that's how they transformed themselves from this tiny little, really just a little blip on the map to the greatest trading empire that ever was, I mean, just before the British.
And when you talk about the British, you actually identify three groups, the Scots, the Huguenots, and the Jews, who were sort of key actors in making the success of Britain possible.
Right. I mean, for most of Britain's early history, 15th, 16th, 17th century, when Hobbes was writing, it was just like the rest of Europe, a pit of vicious ethnic and religious warfare. You know, Protestants killed Catholics, Catholics beheaded Protestants, the English slaughtered Scots, Welsh, Irish, and they retaliated. This all changed after 1689, when Parliament passed the Bill of Rights and the Act of Toleration. And at that point, basically, three groups were able to enter into British society with unprecedented freedom and sort of upward mobility. The Jews, who actually came over with William from Holland, they were actually some of the greatest financiers of the time, bankrollers of armies. They actually made London, they established the London Stock Exchange and turned London almost overnight into the world's commercial and financial center. The Huguenots were very important. Most importantly, the Scots. Instead of wasting resources fighting the Scots, the English allowed, through this kind of tolerance, they allowed the Scots to become the best empire builders for the kingdom. I mean, if you look at who was out there, in all the colonies, the Scots are wildly disproportionately represented. They also were completely central in England's Industrial Revolution and also its leading thinkers. You hear about the Scottish Enlightenment, David Hume and Adam Smith. were both Scots. So, you know, that really served the English well.
And you actually point out that you named several great thinkers of the time who were actually in Holland, in the Dutch Empire, first in Amsterdam, I guess. So that was kind of interesting.
These periods of tolerance, you know, this mixture of both strategic, at this point it's morphing into an Enlightenment tolerance, often coincides with huge artistic flourishing too, because this kind of pluralism and diversity and freedom is very conducive to writing and thinking and art. It's not always, but you see that a lot.
The Jews are an interesting case because the treatment of them recurs again and again, and it's almost an indicator of the potential to move toward being a hyperpower.
Yeah, in Europe at this time, actually, I have a short chapter on Spain, which came close. It never became a hyperpower under my definition, although it was doing very, very well. But that was a time when actually many of the Jews were in Spain. They'd been expelled from England, France, and Germany. Mm. And I see this expulsion decree of 1492 was really shooting themselves in the foot. The Ottoman Sultan, actually, you were asking about personalities, actually specifically gloated. He said, "Ha! Huh, you think they're good leaders? They just basically, lost their best assets, and the Jews have come here, bringing with them enormous trading and financial connections. I mean, they, for historical reasons, controlled the diamond trade and a lot of the silver bullion trade, had a lot of financing, early financing ability, became the bankrollers of armies. So you're right. When they were expelled from Spain, they went to the Ottoman Empire and really largely to Amsterdam. And that really largely explains Amsterdam's turning into the world's financial center for, you know, that little brief moment in history.
Let's look at why these hyperpowers unravel. We've touched on this already, but in bringing people in drawing the best talents to enhance power, you essentially are hoisted by your own petard. You essentially create a situation that leads to the unraveling.
It's really interesting. I mean, what I noticed is that when hyperpowers decline, it often coincides with a turn to intolerance and xenophobia. But I want to be really clear, because this is another misunderstanding. I have a very strong causation story on the rise. I say that you can't become a globally dominant hyperpower unless you have this kind of strategic tolerance so you can incorporate the world's best and brightest. I don't say that tolerance is what leads to decline. There are always many reasons for decline. Mm. You know, bad leaders, natural disasters, overreaching. But nevertheless, you often see decline accompanied by this intolerance, this kind of turn to xenophobia. But here's the catch. It's often too much tolerance and too much diversity that sows the seeds of decline. And what I mean by that is that every hyperpower in history has faced the same problem. As they extend their power to include more and more diverse people, so you're pushing, you're at the edge of the world, every hyperpower has faced what I call the problem of glue, for lack of a better term. And that is, how do you generate goodwill and cooperation and ideally loyalty among all these people that you've conquered and dominated? Mm-hmm. And actually, most of the past hyperpowers never solved this problem. You know, the Persians, they conquered this giant territory, but they didn't have any overarching political identity to hold it together. You know, only military might held it together. So, you know, Greeks still felt Greeks, like Greeks. Egyptians still felt like Egyptians. They didn't feel proud to be part of the Persian Empire. So within a short time, you know, when a new, stronger military leader comes in this case, Alexander of Macedon, they just switched allegiances. You know, I mean, they had never been patriots. Same with the Mongol Empire. Nothing to hold that big territory together. You know, the Europeans certainly didn't identify with the Mongols. Only Rome came really solve this problem. And that's what we were talking about. Rome, by granting citizenship to conquered elites and soldiers, Romanized people. You know, people from Syria to Algeria to Scotland to Spain, they felt Roman. They had this political identity that generated loyalty, and that is really tough for the United States. Mm-hmm. We can't do that.
And I guess what the overall point before we talk about the United States is really that these successful hyperpowers in their ascent phase, respected the culture of other peoples. And I guess you're then suggesting, but after a certain time, there is a conflict with the identity of that those people have and their sense of what they're entitled to or the better deal that they can get from another power.
Exactly. It's so interesting. The very same tolerance that allowed, say, the Persians or the Tang Chinese or the Mongols to put together this giant empire also encouraged those subject peoples to preserve their own identities, their own languages, their own political affiliations. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, under the Persians, the Egyptians still felt like Egyptians. They didn't feel Persian. So there's nothing, no glue to hold that empire together. There's no political overarching identity. So that's the sense that this kind of tolerance can sow the seeds of its own decline, unless you also have a way of assimilating people, you know, and making them feel loyal to the kingdom. And Great Britain came pretty close. You know, actually a lot of subjects felt proud to be part of the British Empire. 1 million Indians fought in the First World War. But the Romans were the most spectacularly successful. And that's why I think that empire lasted so long.
Now, you also get an unraveling at home, in a way. And it seems that you're saying that those entities that have the most homogeneity, the most powerful sense of ethnic identity, which leads to a sense of the other as being the barbarian, either don't make the grade as a hyperpower. Here I'm thinking of Nazi Germany of Japan. But then you're also suggesting that that's a problem of most of the Chinese dynasties.
Yes. I mean, now, first of all, I should say that it's an open question whether it's good to be a hyperpower. You know, a lot of societies don't even want to be a hyperpower. But yes, no society based on ethnic purity or ethnic cleansing or even religious zealotry has ever become a hyperpower. To be clear, my thesis is not that more tolerance always leads to more prosperity. It would be nice if that were the case, but sadly, plenty of brutally intolerant societies have amassed great power. And Nazi Germany is a great example. I talk about that society and Imperial Japan, these ethnically defined, you generate a lot of force and loyalty among your little group, but you can't dominate the world. To put it in sort of un-PC terms, persecution and ethnic cleansing and slavery and genocide are too inefficient. You know, I mean, it's like you waste resources. It's much better to motivate people and bring them into your service rather than, you know, imprisoning them. I mean, Nazi Germany was amazing. When they invaded parts of the Soviet Union, there were tens of millions of people who would have joined the Nazi side, but the Nazi said, no, we must extinguish these Slavic cockroaches. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, a kind of shooting themselves in the foot, if you think of it strategically, in addition to expelling all their great nuclear physicists, people like Einstein. So that's the way that dynamic goes. You know, you just can't be at the cutting edge of technology or have the world's biggest army if you base your society on ethnic purity.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because your book really does a wonderful job of looking at all this comparative history. And we've had guests on our program before who've talked about empire. I'm thinking of Neil Ferguson, for example, and what you are, it's as if the table at which sits the people who analyze empires and hyperpowers, everybody has had a seat at the table, so to speak, but tolerance hasn't. And you're not saying that, it's the key factor. You're just saying that it's an element that belongs at the table in understanding hyperpowers.
That's right, but I should say that I don't know if anybody else has focused on hyperpowers.
Yeah.
You know, I draw a lot on Neil Ferguson's work, and a lot of people have written about empires or even superpowers. I think my thesis is unique, and I do say that tolerance is an indispensable, it's a necessary but not sufficient condition to becoming a hyperpower. It's a special category, Harry, because, again, it's much more normal for the world to have lots of powers competing. Mm-hmm. It's very unusual to have one dominating the world. So for that, I think you need special conditions. I mean, a lot of luck, too, but you need special conditions. And that's where this tolerance comes in. So it should be at the table in the discussion of any empire, but I think it's an indispensable element if you're talking about hyperpowers.
Let's talk a little about equality and inequality. That was a concern of your previous book, World on Fire, where you looked at the interface of democratization and globalization. And you're suggesting in this book that one of the problems that emerges is that those people who feel part of, say, Rome, basically, benefit in ways that not necessarily everybody in that particular province benefits.
Right. There's always this problem. Equality and democratization play a role in this book, too. I see it as this way. A lot of people compare the United States to Rome these days, and it's a great comparison in many ways. Like the United States, Rome was the economic and military giant of its day. He had a really appealing cultural package, togas and gladiator games like our SUVs and supermodels. But one big difference is that America is the world's first democratic hyperpower. It has to deal with questions of equality and inequality. You know, we can't just conquer and annex people and, you know, take their best warriors. We can't just loot resources anymore. We are supposed to be the beacon of freedom and democracy. Mm-hmm. So one of the biggest problems, the biggest differences between the United States and all previous hyperpowers is that we are a democracy. So whereas Rome could make conquered subjects part of the Roman Empire, and many of them its citizens, the United States can do no such thing. Mm-hmm. As a democracy, we don't want to make foreign populations our subjects, and certainly not our citizens. You know, when the U.S. government talks of bringing democracy to the Middle East, it is not thinking of having the people of Baghdad and Fallujah vote in the next U.S. presidential elections. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a big part of why there's so much anti-Americanism. I mean, there's many reasons for it, but the issue today is that the U.S., as a hyperpower, dominates billions of people around the world. You know, through our economic leverage, our military bases all over the world, people from Morocco to, you know, the Philippines to Bolivia feel dominated and bullied by the United States, but they don't feel any ties or connection. They don't have any links. They're not our subjects. They're not our citizens. So they, you know, they feel bullied by and dominated, but no allegiance. So there's no glue. The United States, outside our borders, there's no glue or connective tissue or anything connecting the people we dominate to the United States. They don't feel that they have a stake in our success. And I think that's a really important thing for policymakers to focus on. I mean, I think that would be a good frame of mind. You know, how can we find new ways, whether it's a marriage of constitutional and international law or through commercial mechanisms, mm-hmm. to give others around the world a sense of having common values with the United States and a stake in our success and leadership. Right now, in the last 5 years, I think we've done about as bad a job as can be done.
Some would argue that the post-war leadership of the United States had a vision that would have helped solve that problem by creating a panoply of international institutions, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, that furthered our interests and at the same time furthered the interests of a lot of the world.
Yeah, after the Second World War, we were instrumental in creating a lot of the international institutions that now actually we're resisting. It's very interesting. Of course, there's a built-in tension in that vision because these international institutions, you know, they can't secretly be, they at some point they're supposed to be really international, and that just has not panned out. I mean, the United Nations is, we are nowhere close to having a world democratic government at this point.
Mm-hmm. So do you see possibilities here? I know that you see positive elements in things, for example, like outsourcing as a way to build integration into the world economy, that and the byproduct of that could be a commitment to the international economic system that we want.
Right. Now, it's not that I'm, you know, a big pro-outsourcer or anything like that, but I just say that, you know, we need to look at new mechanisms. You know, by the way, after September 11th, one mistake that a lot of people who were very much in favor of an aggressively militaristic American hyperpower, or empire, some people called it, that is, regime change, let's take out these dictators, replace them. I think the big mistake by those championing kind of an American empire lies in assuming that the spread of markets, democracy, and American consumer brands and culture, McDonald's, you know, would somehow Americanize other nations of the world and give them a, want them to have, you know, be in favor of American leadership. That's just sort of a non sequitur. People can want American products and, you know, wish that they could live here. But if they can't live here, they feel resentment. They don't, you know, love America. One of the lines in my book is that, you know, drinking Coca-Cola and wearing a Yankees baseball cap doesn't turn a Palestinian into an American. So the question is, if just our consumer brands don't make people want to support us, since they don't feel they have a stake, how do we do that? Well, unlike the Romans, we can't put large numbers of foreigners in our military. You know, we don't have a foreign legion that we can staff. We can't put large numbers of foreigners in our civil service like the British did. You know, we just don't do that. But we can give foreigners a stake in our the American economic machine. So that's where this outsourcing idea came in. There's a big debate, and I'm actually very sympathetic to the people who say, hey, I've lost my job here. You know, I think somebody else should step up and maybe take a role in cushioning that blow. But I do say that most of the debate about outsourcing is all economic, you know. And there is a non-economic benefit to outsourcing, and that is that for those, say, Indians in Google India, you know, who get managerial and even executive positions, those people are affiliated with an American organization, an American institution. They have a stake in that American economy doing well, you know, and it, I don't think it's a coincidence that India remains one of the few places where views of America are quite strongly positive still, you know, in this kind of pool of anti-Americanism. It's not a coincidence. I mean, there are other factors too, of course, but that's India is one of the main beneficiaries of you know, outsourcing.
Your book has important implications for the debate here on immigration. Talk about that.
Well, I think that, first of all, the current debate, it worries me that there's so many straw men out there. You know, it just, I think people are playing on American insecurity. I think first we should just say that, of course, national security has to come first. You know, of course, the strict immigration measures are going to be needed. Of course we can't let everybody in. We have to restrict immigration. You just can't open the floodgates. And of course, as a lawyer, illegal immigration is a problem. You know, it's not fair. It's got to be addressed. But there are people who want to go a lot further. And my book really says we have to remember that the secret to our success has been, for all the terrible stains on our history, I think it's, we've certainly had our imperialist moments and our militaristic moments, but I don't think it was through imperialism that we became the world's richest, strongest nation. I think it's been always through our ability to be a magnet to, for people all over the world who say, that's where I can have the best opportunities. You know, it's not that everybody really can get rich, but people have believed that, and we've been able to pull people from all over the world. So I think it's crucial, if we want to stay a hyperpower, the secret is not in militarism. You know, I mean, again, I'm not in favor of pacifism. I mean, terrorism may require strong military measures, but I think the real key is maintaining what we've always been, you know, a relatively open, tolerant nation. That's what I think what we should be. So those are the implications. Now, I actually think that a relatively open immigration policy actually gets to the other problem vis-a-vis the rest of the world. It's one of the few ways we have to still have connections to the rest of the world. You know, not everybody can come, but, you know, people will have relatives that live in the United States who send back money. They themselves think, I know it's a very small chance, but I might someday. It's a country that somebody like me could someday end up in. You know, retaining a small lottery component to our immigration policy, I think, is another way to maintain ties with the rest of the world. And I don't think this is the wrong time, I think, to shut down completely.
Yes. So you make an important point, which is that many of the revolutions, the atomic revolution here that we mastered, the Silicon Valley revolution, that has put us at the cutting edge of all technologies, really have been heavily dependent on people who've come from other parts of the world.
It's fascinating. Right from the beginning, I mean, I did not know this until, you know, right around the time of Benjamin Franklin, we were a small set of colonies. Mm-hmm. Even then, they said, we need to get the best gunpowder makers and textile producers and mill makers from Europe. They were recruiting even back then. Our westward expansion, you know, people going out west, who was responsible for the industrial explosion? First, many immigrants from Europe bringing, you know, skills and technology, but also just Irish, German, Scandinavians who populated the interior, you know, settled the Northwest. I mean, that was crucial. The atomic bomb race, clearest case. I think our winning of the atomic bomb race in the Second World War was really directly the result of our ability to pull in these brilliant scientists like Einstein, who actually lived in Hungary and Germany, but they came here because they were fleeing Nazi persecution. And less well known, same thing with our digital revolution domination. Silicon Valley was not completely, I mean, there were a lot of, you know, people who had lived here for generations who contributed too, but very large extent, the father of venture capital, you know, Intel, a lot of these really key startups that made Silicon Valley had an immigrant as a founder, you know, fleeing, again, Nazi persecution. And even today, I think 52.5% of all startups founded between 1995 and 2005 had at least one key founder who was an immigrant. So it's not all immigrants, but it's a very substantial contribution. You know, it's like this innovation, the dynamism that comes from the people who have the drive to come over.
How do you see this interplay between militarization and a main focus on national security interacting with the great strength and resiliency of the American economy, which depends on immigrants? There's a real clash here.
Yeah.
And so I want you to tell me, as a lawyer and as somebody who does comparative history, what is the way out of this dilemma? Obviously, in this book, you're saying, hey, look at this aspect of the problem, which should help influence the public debate.
A few years after September 11th, lots of voices calling for an aggressive, militaristic America to deal with terrorism, completely understandable. The national security strategy issued by the administration said we must do basically anything it takes to maintain a unipolar world. You know, it was kind of putting militarism first. We've got to do this. I think that gets it exactly backwards. I think that's the way to fall from being a hyperpower. I think that, of course, we've had our imperialist moments. We've had a lot of militarism. But that, it wasn't through imperialism and militarism that we got to be the strongest nation. It's by being able to attract the best and brightest. That, ironically, is what gives us the cutting edge technology, the chip, you know, and it's that being on the cutting edge of technology that allows us to have the most lethal military weaponry. It's astonishing how much ahead we are of everybody else militaristically. I mean, just in terms of our arsenal. But that's where we got it from. So I think, ironically, that maybe the only way the U.S. can remain a hyperpower is if it stops trying so hard to be one. You know, I mean, that if it remembers that its secret has always been, it's almost, I like to think of it almost as an accidental hyperpower, that people want to come here, we keep getting talent, that puts us at the edge of technology. But then what happens is we are able to have the most powerful military. And that's the irony, right? Once we have that military, we have the force. We have the ability to coerce and to invade. And I think we need to resist those temptations of militarism. I think it's great to be the most powerful nation on earth. We need to defend ourselves. We need to take strong action if it's the right time. But I am not in favor of sort of unilateral, preemptive regime change to put in place pro-American, pro-market regimes. Very difficult to do, especially without the hearts and minds of the rest of the world. And if you're going to do it, you know, you've got to make sure it works.
The irony here is the implications of the militarization, the sole focus on national security, is that you get a kind of chauvinism and ethnocentrism at home that undercuts the way we have been so successful.
That's so interesting. That's exactly right. I mean, if you start you know, I mean, I'm an optimist, but if we go this direction of, you know, there are all these bad foreigners, there are bad people, people who can't become Americans, whether because of their certain religion or religious or certain ethnicity, if we go that direction, I just think that is going in the opposite direction of what made America great. That's exactly right. This kind of xenophobia, fear-driven. I mean, I think it's, from researching history's hyperpowers, it's often at these moments of an external attack, people are insecure, they're scared, and they scapegoat and they target and they shut down instead, and then it spirals downward. So I think that's what we need to resist.
Interestingly enough, you address the question of challengers to the U.S., and you're not sanguine about China's ability to become a hyperpower, assuming it wants to be one. It may not want to be one. And it really relates to this problem of, shall we call it, the dormant notion of the other being the barbarian.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, China, I think, will continue to explode economically. It's doing so many things right. It's pouring money into R&D and education, doing great on the foreign relations front, much better than the U.S. You know, I mean, public polls show people, majorities in Canada and Europe and Russia, have a much better view of China than the United States. But if my thesis is right, I don't think China could become a hyperpower. And that's because it's the quintessentially ethnically defined nation. Mm. It's the opposite of an immigration society. And there are tons of foreigners in China right now. It's so much more cosmopolitan than it's been since, you know, Tang Dynasty China. But it's not turning these foreigners into Chinese citizens. You know, that's not what China's about. So you don't see large numbers of, you know, talented American scientists and mathematicians wanting to move to China to become Chinese citizens, or European scientists wanting to become Chinese citizens. But you do see large numbers of Chinese still moving to the United States to become, you know, U.S. citizens. So, and some people say, but hey, they've got 1.3 billion people. Of course, they've got a fifth of the world's population. China doesn't want any more people. But my thesis is that at any given point in time, the world's best human capital, the smartest people, the most creative, the most driven, they're never going to be all in one ethnicity. So I think it's possible that China could become a superpower. You know, that in fact, that China could grow and rise so much, maybe with Russia and India and Europe, that the U.S. basically falls from its hyperpower status and we go back to a more evenly distributed power system, you know, where we have lots of powers. But I don't think that China can replace the U.S. as a hyperpower.
I'm curious as to how your book relates to your own personal story, because I know you, and I think that there's a sense in which the power of your insight actually comes from personal experience.
Yeah, in a way, the book is a tribute to tolerance. My parents emigrated here from the Philippines. They're Chinese. They came from the Philippines. They were actually liberated by MacArthur in 1945. So my dad always wanted to come here. You know, he remembers the GIs throwing out free cans of Spam. So when MIT gave him a scholarship, it was a dream come true. And not every immigrant has this story, but my family had the lucky, ideal rags to riches story. You know, we start off with nothing. My parents were so poor as students here in the United States in Boston that they couldn't afford heat the first two winters. They just wore blankets around. We had to work incredibly hard. And, you know, things really worked out for us. So first and foremost, the book is a tribute to American tolerance, but at a different level, it's also a warning. I mean, when I grew up, I mean, everybody wanted to come to America. Everyone loved America. My grandfather, when he was 90, just before he died, said he wanted to become an American citizen. You know, he had been here for 40 years, but he wanted to take the citizenship test. And, you know, I'd like our next generations to have that feeling back. You know, it's not the case today that you go all over the world and everybody loves America.
Mm-hmm. Well, Amy, on that note, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. I want to show your book again and recommend it highly for the comparative history and for the insight. So thanks again.
Thanks
for coming.
So much, Harry.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.